Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Rabbi David Fox Sandmel, Director of Interfaith Affairs at the Anti-Defamation League, the former holder of the Crown Ryan Chair in Jewish Studies at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago, and formerly the Senior Advisor on Interreligious Affairs for the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism. He is also an editor of Christianity in Jewish Terms and Irreconcilable Differences, a learning resource for Jews and Christians. He'll speak on the topic, Can Christians Learn About the New Testament from Jews? This program, sponsored by the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 12, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Ron Simpkins, the director of the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society at Creighton University.
It's with great pleasure that I have the opportunity to introduce Rabbi David Fox Sandmel to speak to us this evening. He's a scholar of Jewish Christian relations and also an interfaith activist. He earned his doctorate in religious studies at the University of Pennsylvania and received his rabbinic ordination and master's in Hebrew literature from the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Cincinnati. And until 2014, he held the Crown Ryan Chair in Jewish Studies at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago. He was the Judaic scholar at the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies in Baltimore, where he managed the project that produced Dabru Emet, a Jewish statement on Christians and Christianity, which was a major document trying to respond to and build on Christian apology, if you will, for a lifelong, history-long path of antisemitism. He is the editor of several volumes, including Christianity in Jewish Terms and Irreconcilable Differences, a learning resource for Jews and Christians. And he is a contributor to the Jewish Annotated New Testament, where he contributed a commentary on 1 Thessalonians. Since 2014, he has served as Director of Interfaith Affairs at the Anti-Defamation League, which brings him to town this time. We were just talking 10 years ago. I had the privilege of hearing Rabbi Sandmel speak at Temple Israel, and it was only just a couple days ago that I recognized that it was him. And I remember it was just a wonderful experience back then. There's I saw a photo of him from the side, and it suddenly flashed in my head. Yeah, that's who I heard years ago. So it was a great pleasure then, and I know it's going to be a great pleasure today as he speaks on what can Christians learn about the New Testament from Jews. Please help me welcome Rabbi Sandmel.
Okay, thank you very much.
Turn it on.
I believe I did. It sounds like I did. Can everybody hear me? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Professor Simpkins. It really is wonderful to be here at Creighton, to be here in Omaha. And before I launch into my talk, I just want to say a couple of words about the Anti-Defamation League. The Anti-Defamation League was founded in 1913. The mission of the Anti-Defamation League is to fight the defamation of the Jewish people and to secure justice and fair treatment for all. So we have this kind of dual mission, which focuses specifically on concerns for the Jewish community, but also on the wider community as well. And I believe we do that not only because it's the right thing to do, but because ultimately our own individual security and our freedoms are very closely connected to those of everybody. And, unless we all have the same rights and opportunities and freedoms, then all of our freedoms and opportunities are compromised. So we do this in the ADL through a number of different projects that we're involved in. We're very much involved in advocacy and legislation and legal work in Washington, D.C., where we take on issues such as immigration reform, voters' rights, women's rights, immigration reform, religious freedom. and so on and so on. Hate crimes legislation, something very important that we're working on right now. We have a significant education department where we develop programming, for example, curricula on bullying. We have a program that I think is very active here in this part of the country, our No Place for Hate, where schools can become No Place for Hate schools. And I could go on and on if you're really interested. It's adl.org. So please feel free to check us out. And we have an office here in Omaha that does programming here in Omaha and in the region. And if you'd like to get involved in that, feel free to give them a call. So my topic for this evening is, can Christians learn about the New Testament from Jews? It probably will not surprise you that I believe the answer to that question is yes. For those of you who are here for extra credit in a Bible course, you're now excused. No. one of the primary reasons that I think this is the case, and this may surprise you, is that the New Testament is a Jewish book. Actually, I want to qualify that a little bit. The New Testament as a whole is a Christian book. It's an anthology that was collected into an authoritative canon by Christians for Christians. However, a good number of the individual books within the New Testament were written by people who viewed themselves and were viewed by others, including other Jews, as Jews. This is certainly the case with the Gospels. And while the history of their composition is complex, most scholars believe that the original authors of the Gospels, and indeed many, and indeed most, if not all, of the final editors, I'll leave this to your professors to play that out, but wrote from a Jewish perspective, or at least depended on sources written or collected by Jews. And Paul certainly never saw himself as anything but a Jew. Indeed, over the last few years, there's been an emergence of what's called a new perspective on Paul, which has looked very closely at Paul and his writings in the context, I'm going to talk about this in a moment, but in the context of first century Judaism. And one of our mutual colleagues likes to say that some of these authors, this is a Jewish colleague named Amy Jill Levine, who says that the portrait of Paul is so Jewish that she would let her daughter date him. So, now, how is it that this collection of Jewish writings came to be seen as an exclusively Christian text? Despite the fact that Jesus, his mother, the disciples, and most of the earliest believers were Jewish, most of the Jews at the time rejected the idea that Jesus was the Messiah. However, increasing numbers of Gentiles came to be believers. What began as one of many sects within first century Judaism quickly became a Gentile phenomenon. As a result, Christians had to answer some basic questions. What did it mean to be a Gentile who believed that Jesus, as the risen Christ, was the Messiah promised to the Jews by the God of the Jews, especially when most Jews themselves did not accept this? In the process known as the parting of the ways, the separation between Judaism and Christianity, that took place over several centuries, Christian polemical writers drew sharp and often negative contrasts between Jews and Jesus, between Judaism and Jesus, and between Judaism and Christianity. They read the New Testament similarly, interpreting it in ways that separated Jesus from his environment and downplayed or ignored text that showed his love for the people of Israel and his participation in the religious life of Israel. In this view, Jesus came to represent God and good, and the Jews and Judaism were evil and linked with the devil. This way of reading, unfortunately, became normative in the church in the Middle Ages as part of what the historian Jules Isaac called the teaching of contempt for Jews and Judaism. This traditional Christian antipathy towards Jews characterized the church into the modern era. Indeed, the teaching of contempt, again, regrettably helped lay the foundation for what emerged as Nazi anti-Semitism and resulted in the Holocaust in the Shoah. As a colleague of mine likes to say, the teaching of contempt was a necessary but not sufficient cause for the Holocaust. That's an important distinction. While not nearly as prevalent as it once was, and much of the credit for this goes to the Roman Catholic Church, classical anti-Jewish attitudes continue to live today in scholarship, in theology, and in homiletics. And I must add that they have become much too common among Christian liberation theologians, especially when addressing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Christians did not, and still often do not, read their own scripture with a deep understanding of the Jewish environment in which it arose. It's only in the last few generations that the recognition of the Jewishness of Jesus and the New Testament has been widely accepted among New Testament scholars and the general public. This shift is closely related to the dramatic changes in Jewish-Christian relations in the aftermath of the Shoah, as demonstrated particularly by the Second Vatican Council's 1965 declaration, Nostra Aetate, whose 50th anniversary we celebrated last year. However, today the idea of Jesus' Jewishness is so well accepted that many people are not even aware how recently that suggestion would have been seen as ridiculous or shocking. And indeed, I should probably also say that the idea that a rabbi is speaking to a group of students at a Catholic university about the New Testament probably is not surprising to most of you in this room, but 50 years ago it would have been unheard of. It's not surprising, given the history of Jewish-Christian relations, that Jews expressed little interest in the New Testament and regarded it with hostility and suspicion. So let me tell you a story, a true story. A young rabbinic student in the 1960s, in a class at a rabbinical seminary, was given an assignment to read the Gospel of Matthew. He was appalled that at a rabbinic school, at a Jewish seminary, he was being asked to read that hateful anti-Semitic book. But he was a good student. Pay attention to this. He did the assignment. And he came the next day to the professor to express his astonishment. He said, "This reads like a Jewish book." Now, that student went on to become a rabbi whose name was Leon Klinicki. Leon Klinicki went on to become one of the great practitioners of Jewish-Christian dialogue and one of my predecessors in the position I now have at the Anti-Defamation League. Pope Benedict XVI named him a papal knight of the Order of St. Gregory. Okay. Again, just imagine from that initial reaction to the Gospel of Matthew to receiving that honor from the Pope. I think that speaks volumes. Now, just to add another dimension to this, the professor was my father, who was a New Testament scholar and a pioneer in post-Holocaust Jewish-Christian dialogue. I guess I went into the family business. Now, these anecdotes are both from the 20—this anecdote is from the 20th century, but it demonstrates the persistence of these attitudes in the Jewish community. Jews began to engage the New Testament seriously in the 19th century. Previous to that, in the Middle Ages and into the early modern period, Jews and Christians maintained pretty strict boundaries between the communities. And it's only as the modern period begins, and really the late modern period, that the boundaries between these communities begin to fall, or at least begin to be lowered. And a number of factors influence this. The first had to do with what I would call political, including, and I'm going to try not to go too deep into the weeds here, but the loss of political power by the church, beginning with the Protestant Reformation, as well as the rise of the nation state, in which diplomacies and national self-interest started to take precedence over religious belief and religious values. And so we see the power and the authority of the church, not just the Catholic Church, but also the Protestant churches, diminishing at least on the political level, if not on the social level. But we also begin to see the strict social separation between Jews and Christians also beginning to lessen as a result of things like the Enlightenment and ideas of the of human rights, individual rights, the emergence of citizenship, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and so forth. And also in the intellectual arena, science and critical scholarship are replacing piety and theology as the dominant intellectual forces. We see the emergence of the modern scientific critical study of religion, including both Judaism and Christianity. Objectivity, or at least the extent to which any scholar can be objective, the objectivity of the dispassionate scholar rather than the faith perceptions of and assumptions of the pious believer begin to dominate. And this is seen especially in biblical criticism, treating the Bible not as sacred scripture, but like any piece of ancient literature, whether it was Homer or the Upanishads and so forth. So as Jews begin to participate in the academic world, they begin to produce a new portrait of Jesus and of the New Testament that reflects a more positive or at least a less antagonistic approach to Jesus and Christianity than Jews might have taken in the Middle Ages. And this, to some extent, was a response to and a reaction to the more positive approach to Jews and Judaism that was coming from the wider society. So what is this new vision of Jesus and what are its ramifications? So whereas before Jews viewed Jesus as an aberration or a perversion or perhaps a perverter, an enemy of Judaism, this new Jesus, this new view of Jesus is as a Jew rooted in his Jewish environment, a loyal Jew. Now, this Jesus may have exhibited special qualities as a teacher, as an ethicist, or as a preacher, but for the Jews doing this scholarship, that's kind of where it stops. He can be defined and explained in terms of his Jewish community. Now, again, this may seem self-evident to us today, but it was not so 200 years ago. The message of such a Jewish interpretation is clear. To the Christian community, Jews were saying, to hate Jews is to hate Jesus' people. To hate Judaism is to hate the religion that Jesus himself practiced. And perhaps in there is a little bit of a subtext, and that is that, and maybe we have some insights into your text and into your Lord that you don't have. To Jews, this was offering an image of Jesus with which to counter Christian religious claims. Not a negative image, but a positive image, a way in which Jews could understand Jesus as one of their own, one about whom they could speak in positive and respectful terms, who had special talents and traits, but, and there has to be a but here, was not the promised Messiah, who was but another first century Jew. Now, one reason that Jewish scholars were able to make this argument and to make it successfully was that, for the most part, Christian tradition and therefore Christian scholarship had separated, as I mentioned before, had separated Jesus from his Jewish environment and had ignored Jewish history and Jewish literature in their study of early Christianity. Jews insisted that this contextualizing of early Christianity was necessary in terms of scholarship and methodology. And they were eventually joined by Christian scholarships as well. Important in this period of time is that Jews knew Judaism and new Jewish texts, and therefore they had sort of a leg up on Christian scholars who still at that point really didn't have access to the Jewish literature, to the rabbinic literature. Now, this has ultimately, I think, had a tremendous impact in Jesus scholarship and New Testament scholarship, and it has forced Christian scholars to take the Judaism of Jesus and the Judaism of Paul and the Judaism of the New Testament writers seriously. One result of this is that we now have a much more sophisticated picture of the time of Jesus, and a result, one result of this also is the working together of Jewish and Christian scholars, which has now become so much the norm that there's a sense in which you really can't tell necessarily from looking at a piece of scholarship whether the author is a Jew or a Christian. It also, we've gotten to the point where there actually are enough Jews who are specialists in New Testament that they can produce something like the Jewish Annotated New Testament. You know, there are enough folks who can, so each a scholar can comment on each of the books. Additional scholars can write supplementary articles that appear at the end of the volume. That wouldn't have been possible even a generation or two ago. So I think this is something to really to be celebrated. So what I'd like to do now is to take a look at one particular New Testament text, one of Jesus' parables, and to sort of offer a reading of that that takes into account this this first century environment. Now, parables are a form of stories. Jesus was a Jew telling Jewish stories about the Jewish people and the Jewish God to a Jewish audience. Reading Jesus' Jewish stories within their social and cultural context can provide new insight into their meaning, and it also can be helpful in refuting those anti-Jewish interpretations that can still, unfortunately, be found in the Christian world today. Now, it's one thing to acknowledge that Jesus was Jewish, but it's another to understand what that means in terms of how we view Jesus in the New Testament. One significant point that many people overlook is that Judaism in the time of Jesus was quite different from the Judaism of today, or for that matter, and this is really the point that I'm making, from the Judaism immediately after the time of Jesus. While Jesus lived, the Second Temple stood. The Romans destroyed it about 40 years after the crucifixion in the year 70 CE. While the temple stood, it was the heart of the Jewish world. The rituals performed there, presided over by the high priest, were the primary focus of Jewish religious life. Jews were found all over the ancient world, not just in the land of Israel or in Judea and the Galilee, but in Rome, in Greece, in North Africa, and in Babylonia. There were many interpretations of Judaism, perhaps the best known being those of the Pharisees or the Sadducees or the Essenes, but there were others as well. After the destruction of the temple, these groups quickly disappear from the Jewish scene. A Jewish group who came to be known as the rabbis eventually assume leadership of the Jewish community and forge a new way of being Jewish that is not dependent on the temple and its sacrificial worship. The rabbis never stopped loving the temple, but they had to respond to the reality of its disappearance. In its place, they created a system of Torah study, daily practice in the home and the synagogue, rituals that have defined Judaism until today. And while there are many important continuities between Second Temple Judaism and the Judaism of Jesus and this rabbinic Judaism that are very instructive for our understanding, there are differences as well. In this regard, it may be helpful to note that Jesus was not a rabbi, nor was he a rabbinic Jew. I know that Jesus is addressed as rabbi in the New Testament, I think about 15 times, but this is a term that should be understood as an honorific, meaning master or teacher, or perhaps even master teacher. And it makes sense in context. But it is only after the destruction of the temple, and therefore after Jesus, that rabbi comes to refer to a person who has received ordination in the rabbinic tradition. Jesus may have been addressed as rabbi, but he was not a rabbi, if that makes sense, if that's helpful. The predecessors of the rabbis, including the Pharisees and the Sadducees, certainly were part of Jesus' world, and aspects of their practice and their interpretive strategies are reflected in the New Testament. They're also preserved in rabbinic traditions. We know from the New Testament that Jesus observed the Sabbath and followed the festival calendar. He wore the tzitzit, the ritual fringes, on his garments. He worshipped in the temple, and when he entered the temple, I think we are safe to assume that he made sure he was ritually pure in order to do so. He attended the synagogue, and at least according to Luke, could read and interpret the scrolls. But he did not know the rabbinic liturgy or follow many other rabbinic practices that emerged later, again to respond to the unique needs of post-temple Jewish community. So let me give two examples of how rabbinic practice is anachronistically read back into the time and the life of Jesus. In the second chapter of Luke, Jesus, at the age of 12, goes to Jerusalem with his family for Passover. The text actually says, as usual. Yet some in Christian interpreters have described this as Jesus' bar mitzvah. I wanted to know what the theme was, but that's... The problem is that the concept of bar mitzvah, coming of age at 13, not 12, but coming of age at 13, didn't exist in Jesus' time. And didn't become known until after the destruction of the temple. It's a rabbinic concept. And the custom of celebrating that coming of age is much, much later. So that's sort of a silly example. The second example is timely, as we've just come through Holy Week and Easter, and we're moving towards Passover. Due to the vagaries of the Jewish calendar, they're a month apart this year. They're often much closer. Not only did Jesus celebrate Passover with his family, but the Passover plays a very important role in the Passion narratives and in the New Testament's understanding of the theological significance of Jesus. The Last Supper takes place on the eve of Passover. Again, I'll let your professors talk about the challenges there between the Synoptics and John. I'll leave that out for now. And both Jews and Christians often assume that the Last Supper was a Passover Seder. Today, some churches host Passover Seders as a way of connecting to what Jesus would have done, and even turn the Seder into a form of Christian worship, something that, from a Jewish standpoint, is problematic. But Jesus never attended a Seder, nor was the Last Supper a Seder, even if it was a Passover meal. In Jesus' day, the central ritual for Passover was going to the temple to offer and eat the paschal lamb with matzah and bitter herb as commanded in the Torah. The ritual and liturgy of the Passover Seder, and if I'm starting to sound repetitive, forgive me, was developed by the rabbis as a way for Jews to celebrate Passover that was not dependent on the temple and the offering and eating of the sacrificial lamb. It's certainly possible that the Last Supper included some components of what later became the post-temple rabbinic Seder, perhaps a retelling of the Exodus story, the singing of psalms and the like. But the specific liturgy and the rituals that form the heart of the rabbinic Passover Haggadah, the four cups of wine, the four questions, the hunt for the afikoman, the explanation of the items on the Seder plate, and most specifically, the rabbinic interpretations, the midrashim, that are at the heart of the Passover Haggadah were unknown in Jesus' day. And here, if you're really interested in this, you should go to the Seder next Tuesday. So it's a wonderful opportunity. What this teaches us is that we have to be precise when we talk about the Judaism that Jesus would have practiced. And we have to be careful not to situate Jesus in the Jewish world as it came to be after his crucifixion. There's much that we know about first century Judaism that helps us understand the New Testament, And I would add that there are things in the New Testament that help us understand first century Judaism. And though the rabbinic material is later, it does emerge, some of it at least, from that first century world. And therefore, as long as we are careful, it can also be used to flesh out the Jewishness of Jesus and the New Testament. Some insight into first century Jewish storytelling can be found in the literature of the rabbis, and especially in that form of biblical interpretation known as Midrash. Indeed, biblical interpretation seems to have been a pervasive activity in first century Judaism. And one of the common forms of interpretation was story, and specifically parable. Now, neither Jesus nor the rabbis, of course, told stories simply for the purpose of being entertaining. They told parables, a particular type of story, whose purpose is to impart a message beyond the plain surface meaning or action of the story itself. Parables abound in rabbinic literature, and for that matter, there are parables in the Tanakh, in the Old Testament itself. John Dominic Crossan, the noted New Testament scholar, defines a parable as, here I quote, and it's an extended quote, an extended metaphor or simile frequently becoming a brief narrative generally used in biblical times for didactic purposes. He goes on to explain, three elements are stressed in modern parabolic theory. Parables combine the qualities of narrative, metaphor, and brevity. A parable must tell in as short a space as possible a story with a double meaning. One meaning will usually be quite clear on the surface of the narration. Another and a deeper meaning or other possibly multiple meanings lie hidden within the complexities of the narrative, and these challenge and provoke the recipient to interpretation. Parables are lures for interpretation and also revelations of the very process of interpretation itself. Thank you, Professor Crossan. Many aspects of rabbinic parable are similar to those found in the parables of Jesus. There is one major difference. In rabbinic literature, the meaning of the parable is usually explained in the text itself. When the rabbis encounter a problem in the biblical text, in an episode of biblical narrative or in a matter of biblical law, they might offer a parable, an analogy that illustrates the problem and offers a solution. Then they clearly explain what the parable teaches us about the question at hand. In some instances, the New Testament does present Jesus explaining the meaning of the parable. However, there are also cases in which the parable is not explained and the meaning is far from clear. Perhaps this is because some of Jesus' parables are about the coming of the kingdom of God, which by definition looks towards a mysterious future. In this instance, ambiguity is to be expected. The rabbis, on the other hand, as I said, they're usually explaining an episode in the Bible, something that occurred to in the past, or a point of law, and ambiguity is not helpful. The lack of an explicit explanation of a parable is, as Crossan has said, a lure for interpretation. There's a significant body of literature on the genre of parable with specific regard to biblical parable. This evening, I'm not really interested in those aspects of Jesus' stories, but I really want to look at what it means when we locate those stories in their Jewish milieu and what they can teach us. So what I want to do now, which as I said a few minutes ago, what I want to do is take a particular story, a pretty well-known story, and look at it through this first century Jewish lens. And the example that I've chosen is the parable known as the Good Samaritan. By the way, that phrase is not found in the text. The parable is only found in the Gospel of Luke, and the occasion that leads to the telling of the story is found in slightly different versions in Matthew and Mark as well. What they share in common is that Jesus teaches that the essence of the law, as most translations have it, consists of the commandments to love God and to love your neighbor as yourself. Now, here's Luke's introduction to the parable. This is from the New Revised Standard Version. Just then a lawyer stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he said, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "What is written in the law? What do you read there?" He answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have given the right answer. Do this and you will live." Now, the words law and lawyer are accurate renderings of the Greek words in the New Testament text, both of which are based on the word nomos, or law. But nomos is also the standard Greek translation of the word Torah. Now, while I'm exaggerating a little bit here, this section could read in this way. Just then, a student of Torah stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he said, "what must one do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "What is written in the Torah?" And the student of Torah, answering Jesus' question, quotes Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5, and Leviticus 19:18, and Jesus affirms that the student has answered correctly. What we see here, and again, if I'm being a little hyperbolic, forgive me, but what we see here are two Jews discussing, or perhaps arguing, over the meaning of the text of Torah. This kind of debate would have been familiar to a Jewish audience, though, of course, in the New Testament, it's Jesus who always scores the rhetorical points. What is at the heart of Jesus' choice of verses, the idea that loving God and loving one's neighbors is the core of the teaching of the Torah, would not have surprised Jesus' first century Jewish audience. There are a couple of texts, rabbinic texts, one attributed to a figure who lived before Jesus and one after Jesus, both of whom give essentially the same answer. One is Hillel, who, when asked to teach someone the Torah, all of the Torah while standing on one foot, says, "That which is hateful to another, to yourself, do not do to another. All the rest is commentary, go and learn." And the other is attributed to Rabbi Akiva, who lived in the early 2nd century, who considered Leviticus 19:18, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," to be the greatest commandment. And the commandment to love God, from Deuteronomy chapter 6, is part of the daily literature of the Jews, and most scholars would agree that it was part of that liturgy even before the destruction of the temple. Thus, Jesus' invocation of these two verses would have generated nods of both recognition and approval from his Jewish audience. As Jesus does here, the rabbis in several other passages also try to epitomize the Torah in a verse or two. Now, it's in the continuation of the encounter in Luke that Jesus tells a parable. Quoting again, "But wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus, 'And who is my neighbor?' Jesus replied, 'A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers, who stripped him, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, while traveling, came near him, and when he saw him, he was moved with pity. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, having poured oil and wine on them. Then he put him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper and said, 'Take care of him, and when I come back, I will pay you whatever more you spend.' Which of these do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers?" He said, "The one who showed him mercy." Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." Now, this story is about 10 sentences long. It's precipitated by the student of Torah asking Jesus about the meaning of a particular word in Leviticus, the word that's usually translated as neighbor. The attention to the meaning of each word of the biblical text fits into the traditions of interpretation that were common in that day and became characteristic of later rabbinic interpretation. Now, Jesus could have said, "This is who a neighbor is," right? Offered a dictionary definition. But instead, he tells a parable, which, though it seems straightforward, needs some unpacking. Scholars of parable and other forms of folk literature talk about the rule of three. That is, a story built on three scenes. Think about Goldilocks and the Three Bears, or I'm sure many of you have heard jokes that begin, a rabbi, a minister, and a priest walk into a bar. Okay? But if I said, a rabbi, a minister, and Donald Trump walk into a bar, I've done something unexpected and, I think, gotten your attention. Jesus does the same thing by following the priest and the Levite with the Samaritan. It's a clever storytelling device. A Jewish audience would have been doubly taken back by it. Not only was the Samaritan unexpected, but relationships between Jews and Samaritans were strained, to say the least. Therefore, having a Samaritan, one of them, be the paradigm of righteous behavior gives the story an extra punch. It makes it surprising for the audience. It also makes it memorable. However, this is not a joke. It's a parable. It's supposed to have a deeper meaning. And since it is found in Scripture, not only the story itself, but also every detail has the potential to have its own significance. As later generations read this parable, it's understandable that the behavior of the priest and the Levite would come under scrutiny. Why did neither of them stop to help? Is there significance to the fact that Jesus spoke about a priest and a Levite? And let me just underscore also the surprise factor of the Samaritan. A Jewish audience, having heard priest and Levite, would then have been expecting the third person to be an Israelite. That is, someone who was neither a priest or a Levite, just a run-of-the-mill, everyday Jew. So that adds to the surprise of the Samaritan. Now, some Christian interpreters have suggested that the priest and the Levite refused to stop because to touch this bloody, presumably dead man would have compromised the purity laws by which they were bound. Part of the teaching of contempt for Jews and Judaism is the idea that Judaism was an oppressive religious system obsessed with the minutiae of the law. And this includes the laws of purity, which today are sometimes characterized as exclusionary or misogynist, and also, of course, as a burden under which the people suffered. Through this misunderstanding of both Judaism and Luke, one can end up with a story in which the behavior of the priest and the Levite is not merely an example of personal moral behavior from people from whom we should expect better, but it can also serve as an indictment of an entire religious system and the people who adhere to it. Jesus, the Jewish storyteller, however, would not have criticized either Judaism or the temple system in this way. As Amy Jill Levine has pointed out, ritual purity, along with Sabbath observance, avoiding certain foods such as pork, making sure meat was slaughtered in an appropriate manner, tithing certain agricultural products, helped Jews resist assimilation, served as a sign of Jewish identity, helped support the poor, and otherwise reminded them that they were Israel, the covenant community. If we focus our Jewish lens on this story, we'll see that ritual purity is simply not relevant. The first thing to notice is that the priest and the Levite are on the road down from Jerusalem to Jericho, that is, away from the temple. So purity is not an immediate concern. Additionally, while the Torah prohibits priests from touching a corpse in certain circumstances, the same did not apply to the Levite. And let us not forget, the man was not a corpse. He was alive. Rabbinic sources, shortly after the time of Jesus, teach that the saving of a life supersedes all other commandments. It also teaches that an unattended body is not to be left unburied, even by the high priest. And if that is not enough, the Samaritans, who read essentially the same Torah as the Jews, adhered to the same purity laws. So this parable is not about purity at all, nor is it about the priesthood or the temple or Jewish law all of which Jesus respected. It teaches what Jesus thought the Torah means when it tells us to love your neighbor as yourself. So what have we learned about the Jewishness of this parable? First, it is an effective story that Jesus' Jewish audience would have been surprised by and would have appreciated. Second, those who are not aware of the priest-Levite-Israelite threesome of Jewish culture or of the disdain in which Samaritans were held at that time will miss a key part of both the artistry and the message of the parable. Finally, we learn that those who try to read an anti-Jewish polemic or a contemporary social message into the parables are introducing elements that would not have been part of Jesus' first century worldview and that can perpetuate anti-Jewish readings. Now, does the reading that I have offered somehow undermine the lesson of the parable or diminish Christian beliefs about Jesus? First of all, not my business to talk about Christian beliefs, but I'm going to do it anyway. I think the power of the parable remains, and I might argue that its rhetoric is more effective when we view it in its Jewish context. And though I'm neither a Christian nor a Christian theologian, I believe that a better understanding of the Jewish world in which Jesus lived and the Jewish literary conventions he used when he preached would enhance, not undermine, Christian faith. And surely, the message of Jesus can be communicated without denigrating Judaism at the same time. This is not merely the opinion of one rabbi, it's also the teaching of the Catholic Church, beginning with Nostra Aetate and elaborated in subsequent documents, including especially the 2001 Pontifical Biblical Commission's document, The Jewish People and Their Sacred Scripture in the Christian Bible. I love these documents. I think they need to get a publicist to help them come up with snappier titles. Indeed, that document also discusses in details similarities not only between Jewish biblical interpretation and the parables of Jesus, but also other aspects of his teachings, as well as Paul's letters and other New Testament writings. The rediscovering of the Jewishness of Jesus and the stories he told, and for that matter, the Jewishness of the New Testament and early Christianity itself, have all contributed greatly to our understanding of the emergence of both Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism from the complex and creative culture of first century Judaism. They have provided both Christians and Jews with a new appreciation for the New Testament. They have assisted Christians in the effort to identify and to eliminate anti-Judaism from the Christian faith. They have challenged Christians to find new hermeneutics that celebrate Jesus as a Jew as they profess their faith in Jesus as the Christ. Finally, they can help them recognize that the Jews, as the parable teaches, are neighbors. Thank you.
Questions that you might have.
Do you? There has been some conversation, some back and forth about the Jewish feasts in the Gospel of John, and whether or not they actually reflect how the feasts were celebrated during the Second Temple period, or whether they're later rabbinic idealizations put back on the. On the temple period. I'm just wondering if you have an opinion on that, whether you think John, the Gospel of John is actually a good source for how the celebration would have been done.
As far as the Gospel of John, first of all, I would say that this is not my direct area of expertise. But I am going to hazard a guess anyway. John is dated, give or take, around 110. Okay, well, I mean, oh, you know, ish. Give me a margin of error there. Would you go later?
Earlier.
Earlier. Okay. So I'll see you and raise you. No, that's fine. Would you agree that it's of the four Gospels, it's the latest of the Gospels?
For sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 92.
Okay. Fine. So.
95.
I think we need to keep in mind that especially if we go with an earlier dating, we're really talking about almost the immediate aftermath of the destruction of the temple, but we're also talking about the living memory at that period of time. I would be more comfortable saying that what we read in the Mishnah, the sort of foundational document of rabbinic Judaism dated to the beginning of the 3rd century, contains idealizations that were projected back. I certainly don't think it's impossible that John does that, but I'm not sure whether rabbinic traditions by 90 or 100 or even 110 are that firmly developed that they would then be picked up by the author, editor of John, and included. So, again, as a non-expert, a non-Johannine expert, that would be my response to that.
Some might have found it surprising that you kind of emphasize that Jews should care about the New Testament, particularly it's one of the best sources of first century Judaism. Can you maybe describe for us how Jews today assess Jesus? Kind of, there's a clearly a range.
Yes, there is a range. You know, the Jewish tradition is an ancient tradition, and we tend not to discard a lot. So, especially some of the more negative aspects of response of who Jesus is are still part of, can still be found in the Jewish community. And so, for example, some of you may be aware of a phenomenon on the fringes of Israeli society known as price tag attacks, where there have been graffiti or even arson at certain Christian churches and holy places in the land of Israel, and where people write things like, you know, Jesus is a monkey. Okay? That, frankly, doesn't impress me as someone who's really thought deeply about these things. But it does express, really a hateful attitude. And you can see this in a few Talmudic passages, as well as in a medieval document known as Toldot Yeshu. But there are also strains in the tradition as well. Look, in the nature of the way that people, you know, religious people wrote about other religions in the Middle Ages, you're not going to find glowing descriptions of Jesus or Christianity in Jewish writings, or for that matter of Islam, any more than you're going to find them about Judaism in other traditions. Again, as we move into the modern period and social relations not only become better, but Jews wish to be perceived differently, there's a desire, as I mentioned, to not only say positive things about Jesus, but even what some scholars have referred to as a Jewish reclamation of Jesus. That is, if the medieval attitude was, as I said, that he was an aberration and a perversion, there's almost sort of going in the other direction of saying Jesus was fabulous. He was brilliant. He was a prophet. He was the an artist of parable. But what these, all of these, even the most superlative descriptions that you'll find from some Jewish scholars and theologians, all stop at what is, for Christians, the most important point. And that is the prophesied Messiah who was crucified and resurrected. And that really is, I think, that point of difference. And I can understand how Christians would say, well, you know, it's really nice that you all think that, you know, are now saying nice things about Jesus, but you're really not saying the most important thing. You know, I think in the kinds of conversations that you and I are involved in, that's something that we, you know, we accept. We accept that as Christians and Jews, there's a sense in which we each sort of deny what is central to the other. But we're able to do that in a context that is respectful and that acknowledges the danger that exclusivist interpretations, especially that lead to the denigration of others, have had in history, and that we want to avoid those. And that we are able to not only live with one another, but indeed celebrate one another, even if we do disagree on those most fundamental beliefs.
Hey, join me in thanking Rabbi Sandler.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Rabbi David Fox Sandmel, Director of Interfaith Affairs at the Anti-Defamation League, the former holder of the Crown Ryan Chair in Jewish Studies at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago, and formerly the Senior Advisor on Interreligious Affairs for the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism. He is also an editor of Christianity in Jewish Terms and Irreconcilable Differences, a learning resource for Jews and Christians. He spoke on the topic, Can Christians Learn About the New Testament from Jews? This program, sponsored by the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society at Creighton University, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 12, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.